Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 553. In this episode, Scott talks with Woody Zuhl about mob programming.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I have the pleasure of chatting with Woody Zuhl from mobprogramming.org. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Scott.
I love this name, mob programming. I've done pair programming. What is mob programming?
Well, to make it clear, the name itself was just kind of a joke that we used when we referred to ourselves. And as other people started hearing about what we were doing, we didn't change it. So if you think about a mob as being a group of people who have gathered together to take an action, to do something, that's what we are.
Is this something that someone like very smart, like went up on the top of a mountain and then came up with and then brought it down from the mountain? Or is this
I wish that I could take credit for any of this. But really what it's about is the idea of a team that took the time and had the freedom to figure out how they could work well together. And so it's really more about a path of discovery than it is of somebody saying, here's an idea, let's try it. It's an interesting thing to me that this was the beginning of it. There was nowhere to read about it and nowhere to find out about it. It's just something that happened to us.
Do you think that that's when kind of the great ideas happen, that they're out there? Like, for example, Douglas Crockford always talks about, you know, the JSON JavaScript format being uncovered or being discovered as opposed to being invented.
Yeah, that's sort of exactly the idea. Is if you're open to discovery, which means you have to be paying attention to little differences and little hints of things, then, you know, then that innovation's going to happen. You have a chance at it anyway.
And if you're open to the universe.
Yeah, that's one way to think of it. You have to be open to those things that are already floating around, that are inside of us, that we usually don't hear. You know, there's too much noise going on around for us to pay attention to those things.
Mm-hmm. So what was this team like and what were you building and then how was this discovered?
Well, so basically I had been hired to be a manager of a team or a supervisor of a team. And so when I came on, there were certain things that were really important to me. And I'd reviewed the code and took a lot of time to decide whether I would want to work for this company or not and with this team or not. And once that was all kind of worked through where I understood what I was getting myself into and decided to go to work with them, we basically had a team of 5 or 6 people that were working essentially siloed on separate things. Mm-hmm. So one developer would be working on one project, another developer on another project, and they'd assist each other whenever it was necessary. But there wasn't really the idea of this was a team all working on the same thing with the same goals.
Would they have like interfaces that they would share? I mean, it sounds like a pretty typical experience.
Oh, that's a really good point. This was mostly internal work, and it was separate projects that were used throughout the company. Or different departments of the company. So one person might be working on something for this department and someone else is working something for that department. So they really weren't even working on the same project a lot of the time.
Okay.
Sometimes they were. Okay. But it's not an unusual, software development element of an IT department in many companies where there's lots of internal need for software that you just can't buy and you need to have it, you know, available somehow so you make it yourself.
Did the concept of pair programming exist at this time?
So well, within the company, they weren't pair programming. Of course, pair programming itself had been around a long time. I joined this firm in, let's see, it was 2011, about April. Okay. So, you know, pair programming had been around in some form or another since the late 90s, and I was introduced to it myself in 1999. Mm-hmm. And once I got used to working that way, it became sort of my default way of working. After a while, it was like, boy, if I work with a pair, I have less headaches. So I prefer to work with a pair. Mm. So that's basically what it was. And that's something I like to do. But I would never tell somebody else, hey, you got to work. You got to do pair programming. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the kind of thing I would demand ever.
Well, the only time I've ever gotten even close to any kind of mob or coming up with a group programming would be during code reviews. How did you all discover that this was a useful thing? Was it in the middle of a code review?
Oh, that's a really interesting point. But I have seen that in code reviews. But that's not what we were doing. What had happened was, once I joined this firm, there's a thing that's important to me, and that's that we study together. That the group of people that we call a team has to find ways to interact well as humans with each other. And one way of doing that I found really, really works well is to study together. Because we don't have the pressure of doing work that's with a deliverable. And therefore, we can be more relaxed. We're not feeling like, it's one person, you know, that like your job is going to depend on you getting this work done. So we can help each other learn. And it's a different interaction with each other. And I believe that if you take that and really take it seriously, we're going to study together, we're going to practice together, then we can end up with a work dynamic, or I should say, this study dynamic overflows into our work dynamic. So where we are usually under pressure, when somebody comes to us, you know, let's say we're sitting and coding, and another team member comes over and says, hey, I'm working on this thing and I need some help with it, and I think you're more of an expert. Can you spend some time with me? Well, now we're distracting that person from the work they need to be getting done. And the dynamic just isn't really conducive to learning how to work well together. It's just we're working together.
It sounds like you already had a collaborative and fairly positive, nurturing environment, for lack of a better word. Otherwise, people who were learning together might be afraid that they were going to look bad if they didn't know something, that it didn't feel like a competition.
Yeah, that's really insightful, because that's one of the things that happens a lot in software. You'll even see people like a very proficient developer might insist on doing something their way because that's what they're being paid to do, is say, I know how to do this right. So the environment when I arrived there, we were not doing these study sessions. That was a thing that I introduced, is let's open up every Friday. Let's study for 2 to 3 hours every Friday. And we would get together, and rather than just get out books and read them, we're going to code together. And we decided, based on a lot of experience I've had, that let's use a coding dojo style. I showed them what it was. The particular style we used is sort of, they call Randori, I'm not really sure why. But the idea is somebody's going to sit at the computer, they're going to take direction from another person, and that person is standing in the way we would do it, and everyone else is an observer. And we would use a timer. So every 4 minutes, the navigator would become the driver. So that means the person standing giving instructions would sit down at the computer and become the person receiving instructions. We call that person the driver. And the next person in row becomes the next navigator. So what this requires is that everybody pay attention, so when it's their turn to navigate, they have an idea of where we're headed and what we need to do next. So they're kind of following along, trying to pay attention to everything that's happening, so they know the intent of what we're doing. So by using this little model of studying together, for writing code together, and we were usually working on simple code katas like a tic-tac-toe game, or the bowling game, or any of the, you know, Roman numerals, or any of the things that you might do in a study session. So that's basically what we were doing. We spent, I think, almost 6 months every Friday for 2 to 3 hours having a study session together, learning. So there's a lot of reasons I think it's important to do it. We were learning clean code approaches, like how to split a large method into smaller methods, how to rename things to make it, you know, more understandable, so the code can be more expressive, and things like that.
So just to make sure that folks that were listening are understanding, the word that you said at the beginning, though, to make sure that they heard that, was randori, R-A-N-D-O-R-I.
Yes.
And a randori, it's a term that's used in Japanese martial arts to indicate freestyle practice. So you're working on a kata or a series of problems, and you're just kind of switching it up, right? You're moving from the driver and the co-pilot are changing.
Yeah. So if we think of it this way, the person at the keyboard, their job is to listen to the instructions coming from the navigator. Mm. And so we call it a driver navigator, but you could think of it like a pilot in a plane. The pilot in a plane with a navigator, the pilot may not know the mission or the exact headings or what route we're going to take or anything like that. They just have to keep the plane flying. The navigator is paying attention to what heading do we need to be on and so on. And they're giving that instruction as we go. As a matter of fact, as we're inventing the mission, because in software, there's a lot of discovery going on, as we're inventing how we're going to solve this problem, that's a big part of the job of the navigator. What are we going to do next? And as we're rotating through this, and we use a very short timer, about 4 minutes. So the driver's moving out of the driver's seat, and the navigator's taking that seat. Every 4 minutes, a new person's navigating. So this requires that they call it a randori, but I'm not really sure if that's the model of it in martial arts. I don't do martial arts, so this is just the terminology that they've used in coding dojos and things like that.
Yeah, I think it seems to fit, though.
It does sort of fit. So if I was going to be doing this, I think that the idea of a rotation is the way we use it. So the word I think of is a rotation rather than a randori. Because the job of the person at the keyboard is to listen to whatever the idea that we want to code that's coming from the navigator. So as soon as you sit down at the keyboard, you can stop thinking about the problem space and you're just thinking about translating an idea into code. And the idea is coming from another person. Oddly, or I should say, although this wasn't our intention was just to have a good way of learning together. We were learning how to allow each other to talk and learning how to express ourselves better. So that's where this started from. It was, I've done other things similar to it in the past, like lunchtime learnings, where we'd sit down, open up some code, and this was at other companies, open up some code in the company's code base that everybody hated working on, and we'd have somebody at the keyboard, and the rest of us would be talking about how to make it better, and the person at the keyboard would just go ahead and make it better, you know, based on what the instructions that were coming. So we'd done this before over the last, I don't know, 10 years, at other places I'd worked. But once I learned this coding dojo style of the randori, I just loved it so much. It really made me feel excited and energized whenever we did it. So I've introduced it every chance I get. If I'm at a code camp or a conference or a user group and the people want to code, I introduce that. And, of course, a lot of people are doing it. I didn't invent it. As a matter of fact, I was shown it originally by Llewellyn Falco, who learned it from some other people who had come up with some of these ideas at the software craftsmanship community in Paris. Mm-hmm. So it's one of these ideas that have been floating around. But to get to how this happened for us, one day we had a big project that we kind of put on the back burner. It was time to get working on it. And the people who were assigned to work on it previously came to the group and said, you know, we want some help with this because a lot of this code in here we don't quite understand. And we're not sure what steps to take. And maybe we're going to need everybody's help to work on this thing. So we got together in a regular old-fashioned meeting. That's where people get together to share some information and whatever it is we, you know, they need to talk about. And then we analyze it and discuss it. And after we've done that, we come up with some ideas that lead to us assigning work to people and then going off and doing that work. So that's sort of a one typical kind of a meeting, and we gathered for a meeting like that. But a very interesting thing happened. First of all, as we started looking at the code, somebody said something to the effect of, oh, look at that, there's a long method. Well, we know how to fix that. We can compose it. And so they started navigating the person at the keyboard to go ahead and do that work. And as we did it, we just started picking off things in the code and fixing it using very similar technique to our coding dojo. And after about an hour and a half of that, somebody came into the room and said, hey, you guys have to leave. We've scheduled this room, like you always have in meeting rooms in companies. And when that happened, somebody on the team almost instantly said, let's go find another room. Mm-hmm. So that's a really powerful concept. two things happened there, and I'd say almost three things happened there. One was we noticed some problems in the code, and this wasn't something the team was necessarily ready to do 6 months earlier. But we'd been studying clean code concepts for 6 months. So now when they looked at code, they could say, oh, there's a problem there. We should fix it. The second thing was they knew how to fix it using this model of communicating out loud your idea and somebody else translating it into code. When you do that, it makes everybody on the team aware of what we're doing and the improvements that are being made. And anyone on the team, when you don't do it as a roundori, can just pitch in at any time and say, oh, wait, got to change that thing down there, or you need to work on this little part. So we're collaborating now. But the bigger thing was we noticed that this was working well for us, and somebody on the team said, let's go find another room. So that's what we actually did. We found a room. There's 10 or 20 rooms across the company. Went to that room, worked for another couple hours till we had to leave there. But a funny thing also happened as soon as we got to the other room. Someone else on the team said, well, why don't we just book rooms for the rest of the day? So the team was expressing the intent that this was working so well, why don't we just do it? At the end of the first meeting, somebody could have said, okay, let's go back and work at our cubicles on this stuff that we started working on. But rather, they said, let's keep working together. So that's sort of the discovery process that happened. We started out studying together. It grew into one day. We had enough experience working together. One day, we just all of a sudden found working together was actually a good thing to try. And we didn't want to stop. So that night, every evening, at the end of every day, we would do a mini retrospective. And at the end of that day, everybody said, well, that worked really well. Let's do it again tomorrow. So we did it again the next day. At the end of that day, we kind of decided to try it all the next week. So this little team basically just said, we like this. Let's keep doing it. And that's a concept I call turn up the good, which I think I learned from Kent Beck from reading his book on Extreme Programming Explained. In that book, he talks about he had all these practices he knew were good. He pictured them as the knobs on a control board, like volume control board. And what if I turned each of them up? How high could I turn them up? Mm-hmm. And I think of that as being turn up the good. So it's one of the things we've been learning all along over the last 6 months when we first started learning these things. And I think we just automatically got to the point where we were doing that. So we turned up the good on something we noticed was good. And we just kept doing it. That was literally 5 years ago, I believe, this month. And we've continued working together as a team every day since then. We just went from going from meeting room to finding a permanent spot. And then once we found a permanent spot, we moved to a larger permanent spot. And now the team there has grown to six teams all working this way. They have a large work area now. We had just the one team before.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Braintree Payments. Why make payment integration more difficult than it has to be? Braintree's powerful full-stack payment platform allows you to accept nearly any type of payment from any device with one integration. It's flexible to your system's needs, supports most programming languages. So whether you're using Java, Ruby, or Python, you'll always have a range of server-side and client-side SDKs available. Braintree makes payments and your job a whole lot easier. You can learn more at braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. That's braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. Okay, well, let me ask a couple of precise questions that came up in my mind.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Absolutely.
So how many people is too many people? When does this not scale? Is it like, I used to use the term two pizza teams, the size of a team that could eat two pizzas, but not bigger?
Well, so for starters, we had one guy on the team who could easily eat both those pizzas.
Okay. Well,
so
still,
that's,
you know,
that's not going to work with us. However, okay. But clearly this is an important, matter of fact, there's two questions that are always asked when I first introduce this topic, and that's one of them. Here's the thing. It's not about the exact size of the team. It's about the need for us to work well on things. And one of the things that that hampers teams from working well is when they get a question that's blocking the team. So if we're working along and we get a question that the team can't answer themselves, That's a hint that there's somebody else that belongs on this team. Because as if we can answer all questions within a minute or two of when they come up, we can just keep rolling throughout the day. This is something I've noticed over the years, and I call it question queue time. If you're working on coding something, let's say you're working alone, and you come to something you need to ask the guy on the team that maybe is an expert on the database, now you have a blocking question because you can't continue working till you get the answer. You go to their desk to get the answer, and, oh, they're not there right now. So you send them an email. They send back a note saying, well, yeah, I can help you, but I'm really busy today. How about tomorrow morning? So all of a sudden, we have a four-hour period until the next day, you know, and the next morning, till we can get the answer. So when we work as a team, a mob programming team, one of the big benefits is that we can answer each other's questions immediately. We're all in the same context, and it's all of our job to get this particular thing we're working on done, rather than I'm working on this thing, you're working on that thing. So to guess what would be a good size for the team, I think if we watch, if we're getting blocked on questions, maybe we don't have the right number or the right mix for the team. We want to have every question that comes out answered quickly. That means we want to have testers on the team, and we want to have a quality mindset while we're working on it, and that comes with the testing mindset. We want to have the product expert on the team. So somebody really has a passion for what is this thing supposed to do when we're done with it. And actually, the product person kind of has the vision or the they have an idea of what they would like to have happen. The team kind of knows the reality of what we can make happen. And the QA people or the testers, they know whether it really does it or not and how you would go about getting that done. So if we bring all those people together and work at the same time, then we can all answer each other's questions as we go instead of in some kind of a phased approach where we give the work, get the work from a product owner, work on it, give it to a tester. We're not really helping each other in real time. So that's one way. Another thing is, if you feel as a team member that you're contributing or you're learning, then this is a good team to be on. But if you don't really feel you're like you're contributing and you don't feel like you're learning, go off and work on something alone, find a pair to work with, or maybe go work with another team. So the size of the team is going to grow and shrink based on the needs that we have. And typically, it's going to be 4 to 6 people. But there's no reason that you couldn't have 10 or 15 people. We were working on a very critical thing for a couple days, and it found we kept getting blocking questions. And as we would contact the people who could answer them, we'd ask them to come and spend a little time with us, maybe a day or two, because this was very critical to the company that we get this done quickly. By having everybody there for a day or two, we got through the work really quickly. Everybody was acting as a navigator, but not everybody has to act as a driver. Not everybody has to take the keyboard. You take the keyboard if you feel comfortable taking the keyboard, you feel that you can contribute well taking the keyboard. But everybody who's there should be navigating. The need for having them there is because they can contribute to what it is we're building.
Well, that brings up the interesting point. Like you said, the need to have them there. Because when I asked how many people is too many, there's actually a couple of underlying questions there. There's when are those people just taking up space? You know, is the issue of there being too many people in the room being that one or more people is not providing any value or is not receiving any value? And then, could you mob program with 200 people? Probably not, but there must be an upper bound.
Yeah. And
but
there
it
might
also
be.
Got me thinking about the optimal ratio of people and, you know, X number of people times their hourly rate. That's a lot of money to maximal output.
Okay. So now you've come to the second question people always ask. How can this possibly be productive with 5 people working at one computer? Okay, so when we first started, we just had the team we had. It wasn't like, what's the right size? It's just we had 6 people. I don't remember right at the moment. 5 or 6 people. What's the right number? Well, this was the people we had. And often in companies, that's what you have, is whatever you have. But as far as productivity is a trick concept. I can be highly productive producing something nobody wants. So there is always the idea of, effectiveness. Are we working on the right thing? Which is always more important than working on efficiently on getting something done. So part of having the whole team there is that we can steer much quicker to the right thing. We never start knowing what's the right thing to be working on. Mm-hmm. We've discovered that as we do the work. And as we discover that, we want to be able to quickly get feedback as to whether this thing is the right thing to be working on or not. So at what point does it drop off as far as productivity goes? I would say a better question than how can five people be productive working at a single computer, I would flip that question over and ask, how can we be productive if we separate the people who should be working together?
Oh, gee, look, you just flipped it right there. That's a great answer.
Yeah, and that took me several years to figure out, so don't get the idea. So the first time I was asked this question was the first time, or actually I'd been asked it several times, but the first time I was asked it in giving a talk about this was the first time I gave the talk about this. The two things always asked, and so I wrote them down, and I said I better be prepared to answer those questions. But the answer that I gave the first time I was asked, how can five people be productive at one computer? My response was, I don't know. Does that matter? Because it doesn't matter if we can be productive. What matters is that we noticed whether we are productive or not. And if we noticed that we were, and that's what the team was noticing, dang, in this first day, we got a lot done. We all felt like we learned a lot, and we were getting through a project that had been a problem for the company. And we were all getting to an understanding of a project that we probably would end up needing everybody's brain power on. So, yeah. So now, but we got to take this a step further, if you don't mind.
Of course.
So here's the thing. There's a guy named Peter Block. He's a great author about software development and more about consulting. I'm not sure if his talk is anything about software development, just knowledge work and things like that. And he has a saying, and I'm going to quote it off the cuff because I don't have it in front of me. But he says, basically, transformation comes more from pursuing profound questions rather than seeking practical answers. So if we pursue profound questions, what usually happens is we just come up with better questions. And the better the questions, the better thinking we're going to end up being able to do. And what I found is if we're driving for answers, what we usually get when we drive for an answer is just the seeds of our next problem. So as soon as we have an answer to something, all we're doing is introducing some things that are going to become a problem for us soon. We didn't delve in it deep enough to really come to the profound things we need to do. So I started asking that question. As we started pondering this, this is what we came up with. Sure, we can ask, how could this be productive? But what's the real root of this? Or one step towards the root of it is to ask, what are the things that destroy productivity? If we could get a handle on understanding about the things that destroy productivity, then we can understand why is it more productive to separate people? Because if the things that destroy productivity are there because the people are too close to each other and they're working together, then we would have a reason to separate people. So, or to have them working together. So instead of asking the question, how can this one way or that one way be more productive? Let's talk about the things that destroy productivity. So when I ask that question of groups, and I've gotten probably 200 or 300 answers to this, some of the typical things are bugs destroy productivity. As soon as we have to work on a bug, I'm no longer working on my code that I need to deliver. Mm-hmm. Another thing is meetings. I was at a place just a month ago or so, and I asked the team of developers, how much time do you get a day to code? And they said about an hour and a half. So what do you spend the rest of your time doing? We're in meetings. Well, what are those meetings? Well, they're about the work we're going to do. They're about a project we might do next year. They're about reviewing the stuff we've already done, giving progress reports, so on and so on. Mm-hmm. So another thing that often comes up is hard to read code. Another thing is interruptions. Another thing is context switching. And then one that is almost present everywhere is that question queue time. I can't get an answer to something that's blocking me. The information I need, I don't even know who has that information. So once we start delving into what are the things that destroy productivity, to me, this is a key thing. And that is this. When we started working well as a group, turning up the good on working well together, a lot of the things that destroy productivity faded away for us. We didn't try to solve any of those problems. We just stopped having those problems. Turning up the good on working well together got rid of a lot of the problems that block teams. So that was a real eye-opener for us. It had very little for us to say, oh, here's a problem we need to solve, and here's a problem we need to solve. Like, oh, we have this question queue time. How do we solve for that? Would be one example. Or we're always getting context switching, so how do we solve for that? In the old days, it would be you got to go to the change control board before you can get a change made to this software and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we got the reverse of this. We just, all those problems, I should say, many of those problems faded away for us. So it was kind of like we didn't set out to invent that, and we didn't put that in place. It just happened for us.
Mm. Do you think that mob programming is something that the people who are listening should explore? Is this for everyone, or like, do they require some minimal skills or minimal kinds of personalities? Or do you really think it's just to give it a try, and if it fits, continue to try it?
Yeah, that's a good question, because this isn't something that you just can automatically be good at. It's like if you took four teenagers and they want to have a rock and roll band, and none of them have ever played a musical instrument before. We've got a lot of stuff we need to learn to do before we can even discover whether we're going to have a decent band that can even play anywhere except our garage, you know. And garage mm-hmm. bands are great, by the way, so I don't want to belittle that at all. But you get the picture. It's like, yeah, this isn't something you just say, oh, we're all going to be automatically good at working with each other. So mm-hmm. one of the things that we noticed for ourselves after working for a couple months was we were getting on each other's nerves. You know, you work with somebody all day long every day where you've used to protecting yourself from the nonsense of the workplace by working alone. Well, now you don't have that hiding spot anymore. So whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, whether you're a highly technical capable person or someone who's just learning, there's a place for you on a team, but we have to learn techniques and ways to work with this so it just doesn't turn into a problem for everyone. So we noticed that for ourselves, that we were actually getting on each other's nerves. So the first step we would always do when we noticed something, anything, is we would try to find the profound question to ask about it. And this is a question we decided to ask each other. Let me see if I can phrase it well. How would you like to be treated by your coworkers? Let's write that down as a one-word thing on a post-it note, and everybody write as many of those one-word post-it notes. Am I allowed to say post-it note? I should say sticky notes. on your sticky notes. And we're going to gather them up on the board, and we're going to do an affinity grouping by theme these words, and see if we can come up with some words about how we want to be treated. We came up with some words. And the three that we settled on was we want to be treated with kindness, consideration, and respect. And so once we did that, we had to ask each other, well, how do we do that? Because we clearly weren't already doing it, or else maybe we wouldn't have these problems. Mm-hmm. So we kind of made a pact with each other. We're going to pretend to treat each other with kindness, consideration, and respect. Let's do that for a day and see what that feels like. And if we could do that for a day or two, then maybe we could learn how to go beyond that. And that's what we did. So we actually made this little rule for ourselves. I don't know if a rule is the right thing, but we're going to try and learn to treat each other with kindness, consideration, and respect. So if you bring a bunch of people together who are already working on a team, but they don't necessarily work really well with each other already, then they need to build those skills. And we mm-hmm. had been doing our coding dojos for 6 months, which was basically us learning how to work well together. We just didn't know that's what we were doing. Because a weird thing about the coding dojo is the rules that we would follow is the only person allowed to talk is the navigator. So you have to save your ideas up until it's your turn to talk. And that teaches you how to have a stillness and how to be quiet for a while and keep your train of thought. So when it's your turn to inject an idea, you can. Now, we don't work that way. That's how the coding dojo worked. When we work, anybody can speak at any time, but we have to be noticing that someone else, it's their turn to talk. Let them finish what their idea is, and then you can bring forward your idea. And that means we have to start getting good at trying other people's ideas. We have to learn to express our own ideas, listen to the other ideas, and then try other people's ideas. These are not necessarily easy things for programmers to do who are used to saying, I know how to do this, or this is the way we should do it. Let's analyze all of this first and decide on that. So can everybody do this? My roundabout answer kind of is, I think so, but we need to practice it. But it's certainly worth exploring. I would never recommend it. Say, your company, you should do this. But I could say, hey, it's a fun thing. Set aside a half a day and give it a whirl. It's kind of fun. People are trying it all over the place.
Very cool. Well, people can learn about mob programming at mobprogramming.org. And there's a link there to leanpub.com/mobprogramming where people can put some money in and encourage you and Kevin Meadows to finish your book on mob programming.
Yeah, we're working on a chapter right now. It's probably going to be the last chapter. We have one or two more to do. But the book can be purchased because LeanPub's model is to make the book available before it's done. And sort of in a lean way. Mm-hmm. And we're working on doing this remotely. So there's a lot of teams that are doing that. The teams aren't actually sitting in the same room. They're sitting at their computers in different parts of the world and still working together at the same time using some kind of virtual environment. So that's a chapter we're working on. We've been doing it for about a year and a half ourselves, and we're trying to get some guidelines about how you can work remotely working this way.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, thank you, Scott. I had a great time.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.